Last week, we talked about and discussed and conversed about Jesus as a revolutionary, and for certain, the conclusion that Jesus himself was a revolution to the world, and we, being people who at some level are revolutionaries, but more, as David was saying, reactionaries, in that we are in the kingdom. Christ the revolutionary ushered us into the kingdom, okay? And but we are in the process of making those things happen. And so we were just looking at the genealogy of Matthew and how it was a cultural conundrum at different levels and the freedom that it communicated. So right now we're going to go into what is typically a Christmas story, but it's the birth of Jesus and the Magi. And I have a couple things that I want you to think about as we go through things, and then we'll come back to them and discuss them. The first idea that I want you to think about is that the worship of God should disturb you and the people around you. So honest worship about God, I think, should disturb you and the people around you. Okay? Second thing is that we, as people who are in the kingdom of God, who are followers of Jesus, are in a cosmic battle between good and evil. And Matthew is going to play that out for us a little bit. And the last thing that I want you to think about as we look through this chapter and its narrative is, at some level, as people in the kingdom who are still surrounded by a fallen world, but a defeated world, we need to be able to mourn with the suffering and casualties of the people around us and the world itself. That we need to be people who are in touch with that, with the pain that exists in the world and in our community. So our story picks up in Matthew chapter 2, and it starts like this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Now, there's a lot of speculation about who Magi are, but the plural would be magician. They're most likely Persian priests. That's the best way to think about them. They come from where modern-day Iran and Iraq is, and visiting kings is not an uncommon thing for them. They visited Nero when he was born. Magi are in the habit of visiting kings. This is something they do. Now, how did they end up figuring out that there would be a Jewish king born at this point in time? Well, Daniel, 500 years ago, before Jesus was born, 600 years before he was born or so, was in the Babylonian Empire. He was a high up official, and Daniel was a Jewish exile. And he was, at some levels, part of the Magi. And so Hebrew thinking, most likely, we don't know for sure, infiltrated into this priesthood. But these guys are priests. There are lots and lots of records of them heading out to teach about astrology. They're into the stars. They're into telling things from the stars. They certainly aren't worshipers of the true God, but they are seekers. What's interesting about this is, it seems to me, like, if you look at Genesis, then God talks to Adam about what he's not supposed to do and stuff. But when Adam and Eve show up on the scene together, it's interesting that God, the first thing you hear God saying is, "Where are you?" Right? After they've sinned. I mean, the real interaction is, "Where are you?" So God to humans is, "Where are you?" And now Matthew opens up with humans saying, "Where's God?" Just a, you know, I don't know if that's meant to be that way, but it's just a little interesting way of opening Matthew. You have these pagans saying, "Where's God? We're looking for God. We're looking for the king." Okay? Now, this is what's interesting is that they've come to worship him. Okay, and the next line says, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Okay, so there was a disturbance. They've come to worship, and this disturbs everybody. Now, I know that, like, the implications here are this. Herod's disturbed because these ancient priests come and they say, hey, there's another king and it ain't you. And he's a little disturbed about that. The other thing is probably this isn't three magi. No magi are going to travel with gold and myrrh and frankincense, the three of them all the way from, you know, Iran or wherever they came from, without an entourage, without people to protect them. And Bethlehem's a little city, and Jerusalem's big, but it's not that big. When a bunch of foreigners come in, people are going to notice, okay? But I still wanted you to think about it, and I don't know if Matthew's implying this or not, but it seems, it's just what I've gotten stuck on since Lacey in our Bible study said, what does that word disturb mean? And so we looked it up, and it means to an internal commotion, to be at a even keel and then have everything thrown up in the air, okay? And so I just got kind of stuck on that this week, and I've been thinking about the fact that worshiping God is disturbing, but it's not just disturbing to outside people, it's disturbing to me. If I'm willing to follow Christ and what he says, it's disturbing. It disturbs things inside my life. It makes me reorder things. And as we've been thinking as a community about these different ideas about how we might help people and how we might glean our fields and such from some Old Testament passages, I want to read a few of those to you. And then I want to read a blog. And I need to ask you, Emily, can I read part of your blog? Okay. You know, anyway. But let me read just two verses out of what I emailed to you guys. The first is Leviticus 19:9. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap it at the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. And then jump into the New Testament down to James. He says this, if anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after the orphan and the widow in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So a following of God, at least in the active part of it, requires some things of me. And Emily McConnell had some interesting observations about this, and so I wanted to read her little blog to you, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. It says, do you ever wonder if that's really what life is? And the title of this is what? A field of time, I think. A field of time for you to grow stuff in. I think some lives started on rich, loamy ground, and when worked well, they produce fields of gold and grain that feed many around them. Other lives start on a tundra, and worked well, they produce an itty-bitty flower for a few weeks before a freeze again. If I had to describe what my field seems to be, I think I'm a rainforest-type life. Now and then, there is an amazing show of some spectacular flower or fruit, but most of the time, it's just green. Trying to grow things that are good for daily eating is possible, but a constant struggle. Wild vines tend to grow faster and overpower the more practical plants. And while some really big trees can grow, they have to have a variety of ways to get nutrients. The rainforest soil has less nutritional energy than other types. So, what would it look like for me to leave the corners of my field of time open? Will it be time in every day, week, at certain times of the year? Will it be certain years that I leave open and other whole years are harvested and used? This idea is drawing my thinking energy. Will I spend mental energy on this, or will I refuse to harvest that area? And if I refuse, who or what will get that time and mental energy? What strikes me about that is that she's taking this concept and saying, you know what, this idea of it's not just feeding the poor, it's not just God, and in following God, he calls us to harvest in a way that allows space for God and for people in everything that we do, in our time, in the way we work. It's leaving space. And that's disturbing, because as American as me, I am always looking for some free time to do what I want to do. Or, you know, God's call on my life is disruptive. And the worship of God, if we're going to follow in His way, should be disruptive to other people who aren't followers of Jesus. But not in the way that you and I think, probably. Not in the way of our lives should be lives that are condemning of other people. Our lives should be like, people should be looking at us and like going, why do you have that value system? Why is that important to you? So, what I want you to just hang on to is, what might it mean holistically for me to glean my entire life? Not just be taking care of the poor and the orphan, which is important. What might be disturbing for me to worship God? What is it about worshiping God that's most disturbing? And let us continue in our story. So all of Jerusalem is disturbed. And when, speaking of Herod, he called together all the prophets, chief priests, and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ, and remember, anytime you see Christ, it just means king, was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. In this passage, I see at least a cosmic battle happening. Matthew is kind of painting a picture for what's going to happen. Herod is a wicked dude, okay? Now, he has a few nice things. But when there was a famine, he actually melted his own gold down so that people could eat. So he was nice. But he also murdered most of his sons, murdered his mother, had a whole list of people that when he died needed to be killed. Augustus said about him that it was better to be Herod's pig than Herod's son, because you were going to die, basically. So this is a bad dude. In a sense, he is pure evil. And we have pure evil kind of set in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, the temple of Jerusalem, is up on a hill, and Herod has spent a ton of money building that. Okay, so Herod, king of the Jews in Jerusalem, has a big temple, and then down in Bethlehem, little city, little town, we have innocent child Jesus. Good. And so we have this good and evil picture painted for us. And Corey was saying that when she was in the Middle East, she was standing in Jerusalem, she could see Bethlehem. And so here's Herod with all these magi saying, and what is he doing? He's Satan's spawn. He's lying. He's saying, hey, why don't you guys go find out where he's at so I can worship him? That's not what he wants to do. He wants to kill him. But it's just Matthew saying, this is a foreshadow of what's going to happen, guys. The battle is being set. Good and evil are going to clash. This is like a cosmic story. And Matthew is setting the stage for that. So, what's interesting, though, in all of this is the response of the religious people. You ask them a question like, where's the Messiah supposed to be? Oh, yeah, the old scriptures tell us he's supposed to be in Bethlehem. I don't know if they were indifferent, but they seem indifferent. They're just like, okay, there's a new king, there might be a new king, we just got to figure out how to make sure we stay in power. Yeah. It's an interesting response. I don't know why they didn't seem too interested, or at least Matthew doesn't want to say that they seem too interested in this king, even though they knew the appropriate scriptures to quote. So it's interesting anyway, that the religious response. So we have these magi who respond with worship, we have the religious people who are indifferent, and we have the king who's going to lose his place respond evilly. Verse 9 says, after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child and his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they remained in their country, or they returned to their country by another way. Okay, let's go backwards. This is the first intervention of God. We count the interventions. The first one is to send the Magi away. So the Magi go, and they find the house, and they're overjoyed. And that word is the most joy you could possibly have. They were like super excited that they found this house. This was a very long journey, and they must have seriously believed that this was important. And so they were overjoyed. So the way they express their worship is even innocent. They were just really happy to see this king. And so they give him gold, they give him frankincense, and they give him myrrh. In the ancient world, gold is a gift for what? A king. What do you think frankincense is for? A priest. You use frankincense to make the altar to make things smell good. Okay, it's a priestly gift. And the last one, the only thing you use myrrh for in the ancient world is to bury yourself. Okay, so in a sense, another foreshadowing of who Jesus is. He's king, he's priest, and he's going to die. Of course, they didn't put in the resurrection because I don't know what special gift that would symbolize, but there is a sense, at least, of an understanding of who he was. They probably had no real clue as to everything that he was going to do, but they were honoring the fact that he was a king, he was a priest, and in the sense that he was going to die, whatever that means. So they bring these expensive gifts and then they go. Herod isn't happy. Now Herod's a very powerful man. And the other thing, the reason that everybody's going to be disturbed is that Herod is the only king that's been able to keep the Jewish people happy for any level. Like, he's kept for almost 40 years no real riots, no real uprisings. There's like a tentative peace under Herod. And so to have a bunch of priests show up and looking for another king, that means riots, that means rebellion, that means bad things. And Herod has this very unique way, I don't even know how to describe it. He has all over Jerusalem ways of figuring out where people are going, where large amounts of people are headed. This is the way he kept rebellions down. He had a very unique, intricate spy system. But God helps the Magi make it out of that. So Herod is angry because Herod wants to get rid of this king. So in verse 13 he says, "When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. 'Get up,' he said, 'take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him.' So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.' When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and in the vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what he said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. 'A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more.'" So Herod gets angry, and Herod had kind of figured out, he asked the Magi, I remember earlier, "So when did you see the star?" Because he's going to figure out how many kids he's going to kill. Now in Bethlehem, that probably means 30 to 50 children. It's not hundreds and hundreds, that's still a lot of children. And so in our Bible study, when we were going over this, the feeling that we had was, yuck. You know what? I mean, all of those mothers and all of those fathers and children that have to go through this suffering. One of the things, I don't know why I made all of these connections, but I was talking to my wife today, and she was talking about how God has been just calling her to sing. Think about who he is. And this is sort of non sequitur, but that's the way my brain works. My brother has written a song that he and I have been recording, all about basically the unsung people of the Vietnam War. All the children, all the Viet Cong that we never really think about. And it's brutal, and the chorus goes, sing a song about all the dead and long gone. And it goes on and on. It's a 7-minute song, and I can't remember half of it. But the feeling you get is just gut-wrenching. The sorrow of people and death and brutality. And when I think about us as worshipers of Jesus and what our job is that in the pain of the world, our job is at some level to sing a song about the people who are forgotten, about the children who are murdered, about the pain and suffering. I think Christians, our job is to say, yes, there's hope in Christ, but we acknowledge that this world is painful, and we want to give voice to that. Because as Christians, I think a lot of times we don't want to give voice. But this story here, this is not the normal Christmas story that I hear. I don't hear about Herod killing people, and I don't hear about the pain and suffering that goes on, and the maneuvering of Jesus so he doesn't get killed by Herod. I'm going to give you guys a chance to respond to all of this. I just want to walk through the narrative first. So, we have cosmic battle of good and evil. We have worship that disturbs. We have singing for people who are suffering. And you've been counting, hopefully. How many times has God intervened so far? Twice. All right. Verse 19. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and the mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So it was fulfilled what is said through the prophets: "He will be called a Nazarene." 4 times. 4 times God intervened. And I was thinking about this. I'm like, you know what? Why didn't God just intervene by not sending the Magi? That would have been nice. Then we wouldn't have this whole process. It's very interesting, A, that God continually intervenes in dreams. These are very mystical people, and they respond very quickly to God, it seems, speaking to them in dreams. But also, it seems that God's sovereignty works itself out in the free will of people. It's not that God isn't sovereign. It's not that God can't stop anything at any time. It's that God works not only in the free will of people, though, he works it out in relationship with his people. And so relationship and free will and sovereignty find themselves in God meeting people in dreams and moving his son around, who's vulnerable. I just want that to just set with you. Because, you know, free will and sovereignty and relationship with God is kind of disturbing to most of us and trying to figure out how it all works. But what I see here is God coming to us vulnerable and God intervening mystically, but not protecting everybody. There are casualties to the conflict. So, let's go back up to the top. Worship that disturbs. Now, I know I'm taking this a little bit out of context. So for those of you who want to say, hey, it's out of context, I know. But there's some truth to it. Talk to me about that idea a little bit. Talk to me about the idea of what might be disturbing for you to be a worshiper of God. What disturbs your life to follow Jesus? Where do you find yourself being disrupted?
Yeah.
So what God has to say to you kind of goes against the tyranny of the urgent, the getting things done. Right. Wow. Cool. Thank you, Kim. Anybody else want to respond to that? In the back. You have to speak loud. Feeling like a fool is disturbing. So the worship of God sometimes feels really foolish, and
Friday night, the Lord Church, we had a guest speaker. He danced a lot, and I remember Rachel dancing in spirit. And what she was saying about feeling foolish, you know, there have been times when I have felt like dancing in spirit, but I haven't seen it because
driving by. I don't know.
Let me just end this one with this. What I think is interesting is that what did disturb Herod, really, probably, was that he was going to lose his throne. There's some implication here that what his kingship is going to be lost. And I think what's disturbing for us when Jesus comes into our life is that we are no longer kings of ourselves. And that's disturbing because we consistently and constantly look for our own immediate needs and long-term needs to be on the throne. Right, well, and I suspect if Matthew hung around me and then decided I died or something, he said write a note about me, he'd probably say, and Eric, you know, he preached on February 31st, and that was according to Hosea. I mean, but in the sense that, Matt, obviously, I don't think Joseph and Mary were like, yes, this is a prophetic answer. They were living their lives obedient to the call of God as best that they possibly could. Right, yes.
And she's harboring that in her heart. I mean, there's pretty traumatic.
Sure.
It's not just like I'm living out my life that way.
Definitely. This is mystical, and this is cosmic, and this is...
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, God had Simeon and Anna also tell them.
Right. All I'm saying is that, like, as people, I don't know if they were looking to the Old Testament and saying, okay, this fulfills prophecy. But obviously, four times an angel comes and tells them to move around. Beforehand, the angel comes and tells them what to do. If you have another question, quickly ask me it, and then I'm going
to...
Well, I don't see that in the text, so I can't...
No, I didn't see that in the text either, but, I mean, what do you think that word worship means there? And the offering of gifts, was that just a recognition that there this was a child who had been spoken of?
I think it was just... I just think it was honesty. They knew of a king, and they honestly went and offered what they had to him. I don't think we can imply anything more from that passage. But what I want to go back to, I don't want to be distracted from the idea that I do think that what's most disturbing is the removal of us on our throne. And I think so often it's easy to be driven by our own emotions, circumstances, life, to continually selfishness to put us back on the throne. And I think that's what Herod was challenged by, because he's losing his power. So there's an implication of that. But to quickly shift to the next part of the conversation, that this is a cosmic battle. We do have evil and good foreshadowed here. The God that you follow, Jesus, is somebody who fought in an extremely cosmic battle for your life. And this is playing out now in front of us in Matthew. How does that feel? Are you excited about the fact that he did that? What's your response to this sense that there's that cosmic battle and we are, in a sense, swept up in that too? Does you have a response to that? Okay.
Yeah, I guess I don't feel the impact of the cosmic battle
But isn't the isn't the fallen world the cosmic battle? I mean, isn't that
it's the
what?
Stakes.
The stakes.
The stakes.
We don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I follow you on that.
I don't know what the proper word is. when you gamble, there's something at stake.
Okay.
Or when, you know.
Okay.
Whatever it is that is being talked.
Okay. The back of it. Interesting. Interesting. Any other responses? Ryan. That's okay. Sometimes I'm standing up there and it happens. No, I appreciate what you say. You, and then Cheryl.
Sometimes I don't feel like I'm on the stage.
Right.
I feel like I'm the pawn.
Right.
But who controls me?
Right.
Am I opening up myself to God? You know, I can distribute. It's easier just to flow with the everyday thing and just the enemy. Through the background of things, really being control of things.
Mm-hmm.
Look at what I've been causing to happen in my life because of my decision as a pawn.
Right.
You know, being manipulated as a pawn.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I feel like in a spiritual battle, that's what I'm at stake, but I'm a pawn.
Hmm. That's interesting. Like that. So? Go ahead, Hannah.
No, I think of what Cheryl said, the part of the crucifixion going through my head, like a thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, and then the part of it, and when he appeared in the soul felt its worth. But I think that it all started, that it God thought that the world was righteous. But I don't know, I just resonate with what Cheryl was saying, of it was this hopeless, weird, but we're living in this hopeless, weird world, and then all of a sudden there's hope.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as much as I get tired of fighting sometimes,
Well, you can't. And I think that, like, the cool thing is that you're in a cosmic battle. But we were talking about this in the Bible study, is that you can't to imagine the world up to Jesus as in a black glove. It's a black glove. And what happens is Jesus is born into that, and he's going to impact it. So people are going to be hurt because of him, but he's a light that was born into this darkness. He was hope. Like, there really was a hopelessness, utter hopelessness without Christ's birth into the world. It says in Hebrews that Satan had the keys to death. So there's an exchange that's about to happen for life and death. And so when Christ comes in, the hope that we have is that he actually gives people like us meaning. That those of us who follow him, he gives us substance. He makes us human. You know, John says that we were wandering around in darkness and the light came on, bam. And we're like, oh, some of us ran and some of us jumped out into it. And it made us human. We became human. And that's what Christ offers. And so there's this battle so that we aren't human. Satan doesn't want us to be human. Satan doesn't want us to be in the image of God. He wants us to take us away from that. And so there is this battle and it's going on and it hurts people and it's painful. And we're still in this fallen world. And so we end up with the birth of Jesus and the Magi bringing death of 50 children, probably. And what I want, before we think about why would God let that happen, I prefer to think about first, and I think it's the better question, how do we as people who follow Jesus give pain and suffering voice? How do we do that? Does anybody have an idea? Talk about it when nobody else wants to talk about it. I think that's the first step. Okay. Giving voice to our own pain and suffering. Being honest. Okay, so okay. So having an awareness about what is going on in the world. Right. Grieving. This sort of like this prophetic utterance is a pre-grieving for what was going to happen in Jerusalem, in Bethlehem. It's poetic. It says what we can't say in practical terms. And I really do think, at some level, all of us as Christians are called to bring a poetic voice to pain and suffering. Maybe we're not all the writers of it. Maybe we're not every single one of us is not a songwriter and a poet and somebody who can write essays about it. But there's something internal about us that's poetic that needs to come out about pain. Weeping for people who we don't even know or the people around us is poetic because it's not putting words to things, it's actually grieving, it's feeling. Go where with it? Sure.
Cosmic pain to me is not as real as day-to-day challenges that we face of making the right decisions and knowing what God is calling me to do, to be. To me, to feel everybody's pain that puts me in a dark place.
Sure.
And I'm on board
here. And that's not what I'm saying. I think what you're talking about is cosmic pain. your everyday, what you're struggling to do, walk through, that is a cosmic battle. That has implications beyond you. Your choosing to do what's right and to honor those around you and yourself and God is a cosmic thing. It is going to push itself out in the world.
So we're dealing with definition.
Sure. Right.
But it's also being aware of the pain that I feel and the sorrow that I cause and the impact of my sins. Because I think that is something I can do something about that. I can receive forgiveness, I can confess it, I can acknowledge it, I can reach out and say, I'm deeply sorry for what I've done. So, you know, I hear some of the, I guess, blaming God. But, you know, God doesn't make me sin. I choose to do that. And when I
Sure. I don't disagree. Go ahead.
He never let his defenses down to a lot of stuff to grieve.
Sure.
I mean, you can't grieve with your walls up. When you don't have your walls up, you kind of give God permission. You do give God permission to speak to you in a way that only you can.
Right.
So whatever it is that you want to have doing, whether it's your kind of thing to yourself, or whether you solve practical life problems, or whether you do whatever else.
Right. And I'm not hoping for an answer out of this conversation. I'm not hoping that everybody come to some resolution. Go ahead.
Well, the thing that the image of God is light and the dark is real important to me, and I think well, part of that thing about the pain God incarnate, God is with us, and I think that the grieving is not so much that we grieve with or for other people, but that we stand with them, because until you feel that somebody is with you, and you have the presence, that is what gives the hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then
definitely. And Charles, I'm going to let you talk, and then you're going to be the close. So
I was just going to say that that Christ himself did it. And, you know, you read a lot where he was moved by compassion for those needing to be healed or just the suffering. And, you know, Christ rescued me from, you know, a dark lifestyle that I once lived. And now that I have overcome through him, I have that passion, that desire to go and help those that are still lost.
Mm-hmm.
That there is hope, that Christ is real.
Mm-hmm. That was very true. What I wanted and what I want Matthew to do as we walk along, because Matthew's going to solve a lot of these problems for you at some level. He's going to answer them, and Christ is too. But the beginning of Matthew is a broad painting, and I want it to disturb you. I don't want the answers to be here. I don't want to come up with any solution right now. I just want you to be disturbed and wrestle with things and be upset at God. That's fine. You can be mad at him. I like this kind of dialogue because this Matthew will bring us. Matthew's a great preacher. He's better than I am, and he's going to bring us along with Jesus, and we'll be cool. But right now, what I want you to do is just be disturbed. Wrestle with the cosmicness. Wrestle with worship that might disrupt your life. Sit in the pain of those mothers who lost their children for a little bit. And then we'll let Matthew and Jesus take us where we need to go. So let's pray. Dear God, I thank you for this community. I thank you for their voice, their struggles, their wrestling, their understanding of you that often is shocking and powerful. God, I ask that you would protect our minds and protect our spirits and protect our hearts as we spend time reflecting on your goodness, on your love for us, on your birth into this world, and your disturbing of us. And I ask all of this in your name, Jesus. Amen. Couple of ways to respond tonight to what God has said to you. One is through offering. If you're just visiting with us, we're happy to have you. Otherwise, we'd love you to give. You pass that down. You pass that one around that aisle. The other way is in both corners, we have communion. I will be standing at one of them. If you are a follower of Jesus, you're more than welcome to come up, break some bread, and dip it in the juice. It is the place where, in our community, you stand and say, I stand with Jesus in his death and his resurrection. Other ways to respond, there'll be some time of just quiet meditation, and then we'll have some music. The sinner's chair is back there. It's Martin Luther's great idea. It was a chair that he wanted to have where people who felt burdened by other people's sin or your own sin, you could come sit in that, and the community of God would come around you and pray for you. So if you would like to be prayed for, you may just sit in that chair. But let's just spend some time reflecting on God's